I have a radio show that's in about 300 markets in Los Angeles, in the United States. It's in every major city. It's in New York, it's in Chicago, it's in LA. And I've written about 5 books. A couple of them have made the New York Times bestselling list. And I've been on radio for about 25, 30 years. I've been in TV about 35 years. And I was born and raised in Los Angeles. I went to college in the East Coast, went to law school in the Midwest, worked in Ohio for a few years, and then relocated back to LA where I'm born and raised.
And how did you get into the conservative movement or the conservative thoughts, ideals?
Well, I've always been, I put it this way, Pella, I've always been a non-victim. I never thought that I was persecuted. My parents are both from the South. My father's from Georgia. My mother is from Alabama. They grew up in the Jim Crow South where things were really, really racist and bad. And my father does not know his biological father. He left home when he was 13 years old, never to return. So you're talking about a black boy raised in the Jim Crow South at the beginning of the Great Depression. And my father took whatever job he could. Ultimately, he joined the military, World War II, and he ended up becoming a staff sergeant in charge of cooking facilities. And when he got out of the Army, he went back to the South where he had met and married my mom to get him a job as a cook. And he was told, we don't hire niggers. My father went to an unemployment office and they said, you went through the wrong door. He saw colored only, went through that door to the very same lady who told him to go out and go through the right door. So my father said this was BS. He had been to California when he was a Pullman porter before the war. And he kind of decided to relocate to California because he thought people were less racist. So my father comes out here to get him a job as a cook. And he's told he doesn't have any references. So he's treated the same way he was treated in the South, except they were a little more polite about it. My dad ended up getting a full-time job as a janitor cleaning toilets, took a second full-time job cleaning toilets, cooked for a family on the weekend to make additional money, and went to night school to get his high school equivalency. The man never slept. And my father always told my brothers and me, life was very different than when he grew up. White people have changed. The country has changed. I don't want you to be angry. I don't want you to be bitter. Hard work wins. You can't control the outcome, but you are 100% in control of the effort. And before you complain about what somebody did to you or said to you, go to the nearest mirror, look at it, and ask yourself, how could I have changed the outcome? And my father always told my brothers and me this last thing. No matter how good you are, no matter how hard you work, bad things are going to happen. How you respond to those bad things will tell your mother and me whether or not we raised a man. And my father, Pella, was a lifelong Republican. My father always felt the Democratic Party wants to give you something for nothing. And he always said, whenever you try to get something for nothing, you almost always end up getting nothing for something. So he felt that the way the Democratic Party was compensating people for slovenly behavior was going to be the death knell of America. And so my father always taught me that if I worked hard, if I stay focused, if I didn't whine about inconsequential things, I would be just fine. And that's exactly how it's borne out for my brothers and me. So it's really been more of an attitudinal kind of thing than an ideological thing. I didn't really become a hardcore kind of libertarian until I got into college and got into law school and began reading more about economics and reading more about the philosophy of limited government and low taxes and low regulation. But initially, it was all about attitude. And a lot of my classmates complained about racism, even though we were raised in the same community, had the same teachers, had the same opportunities. Many of my classmates now complain about how racism has held them back, when in fact we all had the same neighborhood, same teachers, same basketball, same everything. So I'm just not one of those black persons who feels that race and racism remains a major problem in America, nor do I feel that the problems facing the black community can directly be traced to slavery and to Jim Crow. So that's made me a conservative, and for that reason, people like myself have been maligned as Uncle Toms and sellouts and coconuts, as in brown on the outside, white on the inside, which, Pella, is why I did this documentary that I have coming out on June 19th called Uncle Tom. It explores a lot of black Americans like myself who have broken their allegiance with the Democratic Party and the grief that we get, from friends, the grief that we get from relatives, the grief that we get in society, the grief that we get on social media. And the movie just asks a very simple question. Why is it that a black person can't think for himself, can't be an independent thinker, can have different points of views without being accused of being against his own people?
How did the idea for the movie and the website is uncletom.com, correct?
Right. It is.
And how did the idea for the movie come about?
Well, to me, it's an interesting story. I am often interviewed by young filmmakers, and often they come, they interview me, and I never hear from them again, either because they can't raise the money for the project or they've lost enthusiasm. So a young man named Justin Malone came to me about 2 years ago and told me he had an idea for a film called Uncle Tom, outlined what the film would be about, and I sat down with him for about 15 minutes, and I forgot about it. Then a month later, he contacted me and asked me if I wanted to see the footage. I said, sure. So he comes by and shows it to me, Pella, and I was blown away by the quality of his work. It's in black and white. It had kind of a very interesting kind of, film noir kind of thing to it. And I saw a couple of the interviews that he conducted, and I thought they were very good. And I said, well, how far are you away from finishing the film? He said, nowhere. I don't have any money. He told me how much he thought he would need to raise the money. I said, I'm interested in getting involved. Make me the executive producer. Cut me in. I'll raise the money, and I'll help you write the film. And that's exactly what we did. It took us 2 years to do it, but now it's ready to roll, and it's coming out on the 19th on the website that you mentioned, UncleTom.com. And you can see 3 30-second trailers already up there on UncleTom.com.
So now you're in the movie business as well.
I am now in the movie business. And to me, that's where it is. Young people like to see things. They're less interested in reading things. They're more interested in seeing things. So I write a weekly column that I've been writing since April of 1998. It's in several newspapers and here in the States and in Canada. And then I also have the radio show for 3 hours. I also make videos for a newspaper called Epoch Times, E-P-O-C-H. I do two of those a week, Pella, and they're on YouTube. And now I'm making films. So I'm a renaissance man in media.
What's your opinion on Black Lives Matter and the political environment surrounding it?
I think Black Lives Matter is a harmful movement to the country. It's built upon a lie, and the lie is that the police are routinely engaging in unfair police brutality against Black people. The data shows just the opposite. If anything, the data shows that the police are more reluctant, more hesitant to pull the trigger against a Black suspect than a white suspect, probably because of the fear of being accused of being a racist and the prosecution publicly and legally that occurs after that. There have been several studies that corroborate what I'm saying. One by a Black Harvard economist named Roland Fryer, and he is the youngest tenured professor in the history of Harvard. That's how bright he is. And because of all these high-profile shootings, taking place in Baltimore, one taking place in New York, one taking place in Cleveland, one in Texas, he just assumed it was true that the police were, in fact, using deadly force disproportionately against Black people. He found that nobody had done a comprehensive study, which surprised him, so he decided to do one. And he said the findings were the most shocking of my professional career. Not only did I not find that the police were using deadly force disproportionately, unfairly against Black people, I found out that they were more hesitant, more reluctant to use deadly force than against white suspects, than against Hispanic suspects. A similar study reached the same conclusion that was published in a publication put out by the National Academy of Sciences, peer-reviewed. They looked at every police shooting in 2015, every police shooting in 2016, and they found the same thing, that the police were no more likely to use deadly force against Blacks than against whites. The real problem, Pella, is the crime rate within the Black community. A young Black man is around 8 times more likely to be a victim of a homicide than a young white man. The number one cause of preventable death for young white men is accidents, like drownings or car accidents. The number one cause of death, whether preventable or non-preventable for a young Black man, is homicide, almost always at the hands of another Black person. Chicago is a city that's a third Black, a third white, a third Hispanic. Yet 70% of the homicides in that city are Black on Black. And get this, 75% of those homicides are unsolved. The reason that we're having these problems, in my opinion, has nothing to do with race and racism and everything to do with the breakdown of the Black family. Barack Obama once said, a kid raised without a father is 5 times more likely to be poor and commit crime, 9 times more likely to drop out of school, and 20 times more likely to end up in jail. Now, the question is, why is it that 70% of Black kids are raised without fathers? And the answer, in my opinion, is the welfare state. In 1965, 25% of Black kids were raised outside of wedlock. As I mentioned, that number is now 70%. In 1965, Lyndon Johnson, the Democrat president, launched what he called the War on Poverty, provide all these welfare benefits for poor people, provided there was no man in the house. It created a disincentive on the part for women to get married and created a disincentive on part of men to man up and pay their financial and moral responsibilities. And what the welfare state has done, in my opinion, is it incentivized women to marry the government and allowed men to abandon their financial and moral responsibility. That is a far and away bigger problem than the occasional instance in which an officer behaves badly.
So, but what do you say to those from anti-racist activists who claim that the black on black crime can be traced to institutional racism in America, going back to Jim Crow or slavery?
Well, it's just flat out not true. The data does not support that. During the Great Depression from 1929 to 1939, 25% of adults in this country were unemployed. 50% of black adults were unemployed. You did not find this kind of black-on-black crime that you're finding right now. And that's because back in those days, the black family was an intact nuclear family, and the right kind of values were inculcated into young black men. That is not happening right now. How do you explain the out-of-wedlock birth rate going from 25% in 1965, that's 100 years after slavery, to 70% right now? You cannot trace that to slavery. In fact, if you look at census tracts in the late 1800s, early 1900s, a black man, and depending upon the city, was slightly more likely to be married than a white man. So what's happened is the welfare state has broken down the black family in a way that even slavery did not do. During slavery, a black kid was more likely than today to be born under a roof with his biological mother and biological father, even though they were illegally forbidden from getting married. So these problems that are going on right now cannot be traced to slavery and to Jim Crow. Let's just take one high school. There's a high school in the East Coast called Dunbar High School, all black high school. And in the early 20th century, that high school was turning out doctors and lawyers. And right now, Baltimore has 13 high schools where not a single kid can do math at grade level, and five or six high schools where only 1% of the kids can do math at grade level. Now, explain to me how at one time the quality of education for black Americans in many urban areas produced a far, far greater percentage of people graduating than today. Today, you have a lot of high schools in the inner city where only 50% of the kids are graduating, and those who graduate can often cannot read, write, and compute at grade level because the quality of education is so poor. You cannot blame that on slavery.
Let me challenge you one more time on the claim about institutional racism. Mm-hmm. There are among them black athletes like former Philly baseball player Ryan Homer, who spoke out about being pulled over in his car by a white cop for no reason. Some would argue that it's a textbook example of institutional racism.
Well, again, this stuff has been studied. In 2013, the Department of Justice has a research arm called the National Institutes of Justice, yeah. And they put out a study called Race at Traffic Stops. You can take a look at it. It's online. And 75% of black motorists who were stopped said they were stopped for legitimate reasons. And it turned out, no matter the offense, whether it's driving without a seatbelt, whether it's speeding, driving without a headlight, driving without driving with retired registration tags, whatever it is, a black motorist was more likely to commit the offense than a white motorist. Some years ago, in a state called New Jersey, the cops were accused of profiling black motorists on the New Jersey Turnpike. So the governor ordered a study, hired an organization to study it, and they found out that the average cop can't tell the race of the person in the car. The car is going so fast, reflection on the windshield, and at night you couldn't see anyway. So the conclusion was there's no evidence whatsoever that black motorists were being pulled over because they were black. The governor did not like the study, did not like the conclusions, fired the organization, hired another organization using different methodology, reached the same conclusion. It's just not true. And furthermore, look at some of these cities like Baltimore, where in 2015, Freddie Gray died in police custody. At the time of Freddie Gray's death, the person running the police station, police department was black. The number two person was black. The mayor was black. City council, 100% Democrat, majority black. The state attorney that brought the charges against six officers was black. Three of the officers were black. The judge before whom two of the officers tried their case was black. The U.S. attorney general at the time was black, as was the president of the United States. Now, there's a comedian named Wanda Sykes who once said, "How are you going to complain about the man when you are the man?" So in many of these cities where people are complaining about police brutality, they've been run by Democrats. Democrats have appointed the police chiefs. The departments have been racially diversified. I'm in Los Angeles. Los Angeles is about 40% Hispanic. The police department is 50% Hispanic. It's about 30% white. Police department is 30% white. It's around 9% black. Police department actually has a higher percentage of black police officers, and the rest are Asian Pacific Islanders. So the LAPD pretty much reflects the city. And from 1992 to 2002, for 10 years, during the time of the O.J. Simpson case, by the way, we had back-to-back black police chiefs. And people are still complaining about institutional racism. So at some point, you have to ask yourself, maybe, just maybe, it's the behavior of the motorist or the rare instance in which a cop does something bad, and let's deal with it on a case-by-case basis and not exaggerate and act as if this is some sort of microcosm of police departments all around the country, because the data just do not support that.
All right. So what about the claim that from anti-racism activists about how minorities sometimes doesn't get a fair shake when applying for jobs?
Well, the unemployment rate for a married black man is the same as the unemployment rate for a white man. And if you don't graduate and you can read, write, and compute at grade level, if you don't have the appropriate skills, if you're not respectful, you're probably not going to have a good chance of getting a job. Every one of the Fortune 500 companies in America, Pella, has something called an outreach or a diversity consultant or somebody to make sure that the workforce is diverse, because it's just good business not to be perceived as racist. Now, from time to time, I get a inquiry about some study that shows if you have a so-called black-sounding name, you're less likely to be called for an interview than if you don't have a black-sounding name. And I've seen those studies, and apparently that data is true. What they don't tell you, however, is that black employers are just as unlikely to call somebody who's got a black-sounding name, and so-called white-sounding names like Penelope and Gertrude are also discriminated against. So if the way to solve racism is simply to give your child a non-black-sounding name, then it seems to me we don't have a whole lot to complain about.
So there have been numerous incidents where white Black Lives Matter activists are participating in activities such as kneeling to Afro-Americans and similar stuff like that. Have you seen this, and do you have any comments on it?
I have seen it. One more comment, though, about black being discriminated against in the workforce. For a long time, a black college-educated couple where both work out-earns a white college-educated couple where both work. That's been the case for a very long period of time. Now, if the discrimination that takes place in the workforce were true, why is that the case? The bottom line is, if you look at somebody's skill level and compare that person to another person's skill level, their careers are going to be about the same. It has to do with your quality, your ability to apply yourself, and so forth. Women complain that they're being paid less than men. And when you take time out to have children, it's going to hurt your career. But if you compare women to women that have been at the same company, same quality of education to a man, there's no difference in their incomes. Now, as to this business about laying down and kneeling, a prostrate to reflect over your guilt for being a white person, I have a real problem with that. Again, the number one problem facing the black community is not bad cops. It's the broken down family. That's what's causing the crime. We ought to be dealing with that. There's no reason for white people to feel guilty about slavery and about Jim Crow. They had nothing whatever to do with it. The whole movement for reparations, Pella, in my opinion, is the extraction of money from people who are never slave owners to be given to people who are never slaves. The whole thing is absurd. Furthermore, only about 5% of white people have any sort of generational connection to slavery. Either their ancestors fought on the northern side, or as was the case in the South, most Southerners never owned slaves because they were expensive and they were hard to keep. You had to maintain them, watch them so they didn't run away, feed them and all that. So most people in the South never owned slaves. So when you're talking about the generational connection to slavery, maybe about 5% of white people can say that they have it. And furthermore, Republicans, for the most part, didn't own slaves. It was a Democratic institution, and the government never owned slaves. Democrats did. So how is it the government taxpayer is supposed to pay people for reparations when the government never owned slaves, A, and when B, it was Democrats who owned them? So maybe the Democrat Party should pay the reparations to the rest of the people. The whole thing is absurd. The idea of going back into history and righting the wrongs, we could do that all night long. What about the fact that Barbary pirates took white slaves from the Caribbean in numbers greater than European slavers took blacks out of Africa and took them to the colonies or to what ultimately became America? We can play this game all day long. Every race engaged in slavery. Asians enslaved Asians, whites enslaved whites. The slave trade could not have worked if black chieftains had not conquered other blacks and sold them in mass to white European slavers. So nobody has clean hands in this argument. You want to go back and airbrush history, you'll be doing that for a very long period of time. The question is, what do we do today?
Yes.
I argue that all a state can be is just in its own time, and that is what America has always struggled to be, just in its own time, and that's what we're doing now.
So why now? Why is the Black Lives so strong, and why is from large companies to Republicans such as Mitt Romney, why are everyone, or at least a lot of people and companies, embracing Black Lives Matter?
Well, why have the left taken over colleges and academia? You look at studies that show in a typical history department of a large university, you may find one person registered as a Republican or as a non-Democrat. You're in luck if you can find that. Why has the left taken over Hollywood, making movies like Hurricane that celebrate the life of somebody, in my opinion, who murdered three people? And why have the left taken over the media? The media is dominated by left-wing people. So you're talking about a culture that's dominated by the left and a culture that is kowtowing to the demands of the Black Lives Matter movement because they feel it is in their best financial interest to do so.
Do you see any connection to the upcoming election?
Oh, yeah. I think part of this whole movement is because of hostility towards Trump. I think a lot of people in the streets protesting over the last several days are doing it in part because Donald Trump is president of the United States and they feel that he's a racist and has given permission for racists to be racist, even though the data shows he got actually a smaller percentage of the white vote than Mitt Romney did and a higher percentage of the black vote than Mitt Romney did. And black unemployment before the coronavirus hit all-time low for black people. President has done something called the First Step Act, which allows people in prison to have their prison sentences reviewed. And 1,000 prisoners, most of them have been black men, have had their prison sentences reduced an average of 70 months under this president. He's also pardoned the first black heavyweight champion. His name was Jack Johnson. A request was made by Republican presidents and Democratic presidents, including Barack Obama, to pardon him. Obama never did. This guy did. He's also increased spending on historically black colleges and increased spending on what are called enterprise zones for the inner city. So if he's a racist, he needs to go back to racism school. Yet he is perceived as racist by the media and by much of many black people. 80% of Democrats, over 80%, according to one recent poll, called Donald Trump racist. Over 60% of Democrats feel Republicans in general are racist, sexist, and bigoted. And so that's the image that the Republican Party has, unfortunately. And because our culture is dominated in the news, in Hollywood, and academia by left-wing people, you will find a great deal of sympathy for stupid movements like Black Lives Matter.
And one thing, Pella, it
would be one thing if the movement were just based upon false data. There are a lot of left-wing people that believe foolish things. But this is getting people killed. There's something called the Ferguson effect, and that is when cops are accused of racism, they pull back. After all, these are human beings. They have wives. They have spouses. They want to get home. And if the community does not want aggressive, proactive policing, fine. You're not going to get aggressive, proactive policing. And what happens? They pull back. Bad guys know it, and crime goes up. The mayor of Chicago, after there was a high-profile police shooting, said that the police, in response, have rolled themselves into a fetal position, his word, not mine, and crime has gone up. And the people most vulnerable for this increased crime are the very black and brown people that the Black Lives Matter activists claim that they care about.
There are there are arguments here in Sweden, though, then that the Black Lives Matter movement is coming to Sweden and Europe, obviously, and some defend the Swedish police force by saying that, the American police force is bad. The Swedish police isn't the same as the American police force. Is that a false narrative, or is that a bad way of arguing?
Well, I just can't say what the police practices are in your country, but I know what they are here. Every 2 or 3 years, there is a survey conducted by the FBI. It's called the Police Public Contact Survey. And they asked 60,000 Americans, have you had contact with the police in the last year? If the answer is yes, they then ask a series of questions about the experience they had. Were you mistreated? Were you verbally mistreated? Were you physically mistreated? And this has been going on now for years. They've been doing this study now for years, and they cannot find any evidence whatsoever of disproportionate deadly force or unfair force used against Black people. The data are just not there. And you know it's not true because this is a very litigious society. We've got a bunch of lawyers in America. Many of them are defense lawyers. And it would not be very difficult for them to put together a class action lawsuit and sue a whole bunch of cities for their alleged institutional racism. And they would also get treble damages. So there would be an economic incentive to file a lawsuit against the police department and prove that they were engaging in racism against Black people. The data simply are not there. Some years ago in L.A., there was a big push by the ACLU to require officers to record the race of every person that they talked to that they stopped. In years past, you pull over somebody, you have a conversation with the person, and they would go. Now, every time you pull over somebody, you have to write down the race of the driver. So we've been doing this for years now. And what have they done with the data? Nothing, because they can't find any kind of pattern of abuse. If anything, it is demonstrated that the police are not engaging in the kind of conduct that they're accused of. I'll give you one more example, Pella.
Mm-hmm.
There's a city in California called Rialto. It has about 100,000 people. And the police department was mandated to wear a body cam. They didn't want to. The officer did not feel like they wanted to be followed around like that, but they were ordered to, and they did so. And after a year, guess what happened? Police complaints filed against the police by civilians fell 90%. The police use of force fell 50%. Not because the police were engaging in any kind of different behavior. Civilians changed their behavior, Pella, once they knew they were watched. Once they knew they were watched, they stopped lying on the police. They stopped making the false police complaints, because to lodge a false complaint against a police officer is a felony. So it turns out that apparently for years and years, these people that have filed these complaints against cops were lying. And when they had to corroborate the complaint, they stopped lying. And as a result, they stopped challenging officers. They stopped using the same kind of force against officers. And officers did not have to respond the same way. So officer use of force fell 50%. And again, it's because the civilians stopped lying.
All right. First, I'd like to hear your opinion on the idea that is brought up now, that monuments and statues are to be removed and decapitated in certain instances.
Well, I think it's absurd. I think it's airbrushing history. And we've had a troubled history in this country. We had a mighty, mighty civil war that resulted in over 500,000 lives, both sides. And think about that. Adjust that for today's population, because at the time, the population was only a tenth of what it is right now. So that's the equivalent of almost 5 or 6 million people dying in order to have the conclusion that slavery is over. And it's a long, tortured history. And to remove all the Confederate monuments is to suggest this never occurred. I'm not interested also in airbrushing movies like Gone with the Wind. Right now, there's a big controversy over Gone with the Wind because some people feel it glorifies the South. Well, it was a monumental piece of art and cinema. The use of color was incredible. It was an epic performance. It's a love story. It's not my favorite movie. I don't really care for that genre of love stories. And it did, in my opinion, kind of make the South and slavery look not all that bad. So for all sorts of reasons, as a Black person, I'm not crazy about the movie, but it certainly does not offend me. And I asked my mother and my father when they were alive, obviously, both again from the South, how they felt about the movie. My father had barely seen it. He thought of it. It was not on his radar. My mother had seen it several times and loved it. And I finally saw it in my 30s because it never appealed to me. And when I finished seeing it, I was seeing it with a girlfriend who loved it, had seen it about a dozen times. She thought it was the greatest movie ever. And I turned to her and I said, boy, that was long. So I just don't get the furor about that. You know, it doesn't affect Larry Elder's life. Speaking of affecting my life.
One more thing.
There was a poll in 1997. So we're talking about what, 21 years ago. Time and CNN conducted this poll, a massive poll, asking black teens and white teens their various attitudes about various things. They asked them both whether racism remained a major problem in America, and both black teens and white teens said yes. But then, Pella, this happened. They asked the black teens follow-up questions. Is racism a major problem in your own life, a minor problem in your own life, or a small problem in your own life, or no problem in your own life? 89% of these black teens said racism was a small problem or no problem in my own daily life. In fact, more black teens than white teens agreed with the following proposition. Failure to take advantage of available opportunities is a bigger problem than racism. More black teens in 1997 said yes to that proposition than did white teens. And now we're talking about institutional racism. After America has elected a black man for president and reelected that black man for president, we had back-to-back black secretaries of state under George W. Bush. We had back-to-back black attorneys general under Barack Obama. And in those 8 years, there were several police shootings, Pella, and not a single time did the Obama Department of Justice bring civil rights actions against any of the officers that were involved in the death of Freddie Gray or Eric Garner or Tamir Rice or Trayvon Martin. Not a single time, because the data, the evidence simply was not there. The Obama administration made a big display. We're going to go into Baltimore and we're going to investigate whether or not these officers engaged in any kind of civil rights violations against Freddie Gray. Nothing happened because the evidence was not there.
In your book, Showdown, you coined the term black victocrats. Right. How does that turn today's narrative of Black Lives Matter?
Well, it means that you feel that anything that's gone wrong in your life can be traced to somebody else having done something to you. You have a victim mentality, and the term victocrat is a term that I invented. And it doesn't apply just to black people. It applies to anybody who feels that he or she has no control of his or her life, that other people are controlling it, and that you are a victim. I have a very close friend I've known since the second grade, Pella. I go to college, I go to law school, I come back, I visit him, and he's angry at the world. He's angry at racism. And I reminded him that we grew up not six blocks apart from each other. We attended the same elementary school, the same middle school, the same high school, had the same teachers, had the same opportunities. How is it that I progressed and you didn't? Answer, you sat around and you complained, you didn't work hard. Look in the mirror. That's your enemy, not the white man.
Let me ask you about, you mentioned Gone with the Wind. As a black man, did you ever get offended by the books by Mark Twain?
No, I didn't. I read Huckleberry Finn. I read Tom Sawyer. I thought they were wonderful. And I saw the movie or the Disney version of Huckleberry Finn. It's a piece of Americana. They're great pieces of literature. And remember the relationship between Tom Sawyer and Old Jim. Rather Huckleberry Finn and Old Jim. They had a tremendous relationship that transcended racism. Again, let's not act like America did not have a period of time where it was racist. Of course it was. And the airbrush history is absolutely, totally ridiculous. Furthermore, what's the point? Is the point to make black people feel better? If that's your goal, black people already feel better. For decades, tests have shown that black people have higher self-esteem than do white people, especially black women. Black women have much higher self-images. Black women don't feel that they need to have a Barbie doll physique the way a lot of white girls do. So it turns out that survey after survey after survey has shown that black Americans feel more confident and have a higher opinion of themselves than do white Americans, and much higher opinion of themselves than do Asian Americans. So if the goal is to make black people feel better about themselves, mission accomplished.
All right. So one final question. What's the solution? How do we deal with the current situation?
The solution is to recognize this is not your grandfather's America and pick up your cards and play them to the best of your ability. There has never been a better time to live in the world. We've never had greater resources. We never had greater access to information and to knowledge. And the goal now is to take advantage of the resources we have right now and stop complaining about what you don't have and start working real hard to acquire what you want.